Never go to the second location. Always trust your gut.
Hello, my name is Chrissy Champagne, and you are listening to Residue, a true crime podcast dedicated to keeping you paranoid. Today's episode is a very highly requested film. We're going to be talking about An American Crime, starring Elliot Page and Catherine Keener, and I have to give you the most major trigger warning for this episode. This episode discusses An American Crime and contains references to severe child abuse, torture, neglect, and death. And this subject matter is based on real events and may be deeply disturbing or upsetting. Listener discretion is strongly advised. I need you to know that you need to please take care of yourself and skip this episode if these topics are difficult for you. Because let me tell you something. This was a very difficult research week. I had to stop the book a couple times, and there are a few books on this case. I chose to go with the book Torture Mom by Ryan Green. It was a shorter book because even listening to this book on Audible, I had to fast forward quite a bit. And I'll just say it again, these themes are very graphic. They are very, very distressing. And I would love it if you would just please prioritize your well-being and pause, skip, or step away if needed. I think that next week I'll do a cursed film or maybe something spooky because I need a little bit of a break myself. So just to get down to business real quick, you guys know that you can follow me on Instagram at Residue Podcast, TikTok and Facebook at Residue, a true crime podcast. And the best thing you can possibly do is leave a 5-star review. I still have stickers and I know that I have been getting some fantastic, lovely reviews. If you guys want a sticker, a thank you note, you just DM me on one of those social media sites and I will get those right out to you. Thank you so much for being here with me, my Resi crew, and don't forget to hit that follow button so you can join us back here every single Tuesday. Okay, you guys, we are talking about An American Crime, the story of Sylvia Likens. An American Crime is a 2007 crime drama based on a tragic true crime from the 1960s, and it depicts one of the most disturbing real-life cases of abuse in U.S. history. This film stars Catherine Keener as Gertrude Beneshefsky, Elliot Page as Sylvia Likens, and James Franco as Andy. You will also see a very young Evan Peters in this film. So this film dramatizes the true story of Sylvia Likens, a teenage girl who was left in the care of Gertrude Beneshefsky while her parents were traveling with a carnival. And instead of a safe home, Sylvia became the victim of escalating abuse over a period of weeks. Gertrude and her children, along with neighborhood kids, tortured, humiliated, and physically harmed Sylvia in their Indiana home. Catherine Keener delivers a chilling performance as Gertrude, a woman whose volatile discipline deteriorates into sadism, and Elliot Page is central as Sylvia, embodying the innocence and tragic suffering that defines the film's emotional core. James Franco appears in a supporting role, a very small role, as Andy, Gertrude's younger boyfriend, whose presence complicates the household dynamics. Now, this part might have been dramatized for the film because in the book that I read, Torture Mom by Ryan Green, I didn't really hear any mention of Andy, who is actually Dennis in real life, ever really complicating the situation by flirting with Sylvia like they depict in the movie. So this movie deals with very disturbing and graphic material, including abuse and violence, and it is widely considered not suitable for all audiences, and it's often recommended only for mature viewers who can handle intense drama rooted in real events. I mean, in other words, if you're going to be able to make it through this movie, this is a one-time watch for sure. There is also another movie titled The Girl Next Door, which is about the Sylvia Likens case, but I chose to focus on An American Crime today. On Rotten Tomatoes, An American Crime has a 40% critics and a 74% audience and shows that reactions were mixed, but many viewers are moved by this film. I think the ending is so fantastically well done, it will bring a tear to your eye. Critics and some reviewers have noted that the film's graphic depiction of torture and the emotional weight of this film makes it really hard to watch, but it's also thought-provoking in how it tackles real human evil. Over 100 cigarette burns, second and third degree burns, severe bruising, muscular and nerve damages, multiple brain hemorrhages, and the cause of death could have been the combined shock of all of these injuries. Sylvia Likens was the third of five children born to carnival workers Lester Likens and Elizabeth Francis, who goes by Betty. So she was born between two sets of fraternal twins. She had a brother and a sister, Daniel and Diana, who were 2 years older than her, and then Benny and Jenny were 1 year older than her. And Jenny, her younger sister, she suffered from polio. Sylvia's parents had a really unstable marriage, and they weren't very financially secure. They traveled from carnival to carnival, and a lot of times the kids were able to travel with them because they would just have the kids help out and work also. So as they get older, the boys would work with the parents a lot, but the girls were discouraged from coming along, so the girls would usually stay with relatives. Sylvia loved music. She loved roller skating to her favorite music, and her favorite band of all time was the Beatles. And Sylvia's really protective of her younger sister because Jenny was a little more insecure, especially because of her polio. And so they would go roller skating together. Sylvia would help her roller skate by holding her hand the entire time. So it's June 1965. The Likens are residing in Indianapolis, and Sylvia and Jenny are new to town, so they're just walking around exploring the neighborhood, and they meet this girl named Darlene. And Darlene tells them, hey, I have this friend named Paula Banaszewski. Now, Paula lives in the neighborhood hangout house. I'm talking like That 70s Show. All the kids in the neighborhood are constantly at Paula's house, and Paula has a lot of brothers and sisters. So Paula has six brothers and sisters. We have Paula. She's 17. Stephanie is 15. John is 12. Marie is 11. Shirley is 10. James is 8. And Dennis Lee Wright Jr. is 1. And their mother is Gertrude Banaszewski. She is a single mother of seven children. And now Gertrude allowed all of the neighborhood kids to stay in her house constantly. They loved to go there. She let them smoke. She let them drink. It didn't matter how old they were. So Paula invites Sylvia and Jenny over to her house. And so they're all hanging out at her house and they're listening to records. They're doing girly things. They meet Gertrude, and their father, Lester, is looking everywhere for them because turns out their mother, Betty, has been arrested. And now the family needs to find a place for all of the kids because he needs to get Betty out of jail. And then those two have to hop back on the road and get back to the carny life. So the boys of the family are going to go stay with their grandparents, but they don't know where they're going to put the girls, Jenny and Sylvia, because their older sister, Diana, is old enough to be on her own. So Diana's taken care of. Lester needs somewhere for Sylvia and Jenny to stay. So he's looking everywhere for his girls this day, and he comes across Darlene. Darlene's always, you know, around the neighborhood. So he's like, I'm looking for my two daughters, Sylvia and Jenny. She's like, oh, I know where they are. Come with me. So Darlene takes Lester to Gertrude's house, and he meets Gertrude. He doesn't even go inside of the house, mind you. But he starts telling Gertrude outside, they're on the porch, you know, I don't know where I'm going to let my girls stay. It's, you know, if you could take them in, that would be wonderful. I'll pay you $20 a week guaranteed. And this is 1965. Gertrude needs that $20 a week. At this point, she doesn't have a job. She's depending on child support from her first husband, and she's also taking odd jobs from the neighbors at this point. Like, she'll tell you that she'll iron your laundry for the week, or she'll sew your clothes. So she is ecstatic that this man that she she doesn't even know, shows up on her porch and he's like, hey, take my two kids in. And she makes a joke about it. She says, well, it's fine with me. I have so many kids in this house anyway, I won't even notice if there's two more. Had this man just stepped inside of that home to take a look around for a little bit, he would have seen how disgusting it was. I'm talking dirt on the floors, and some of the kids slept in the same mattress. Like, there was one mattress for five kids. So when Sylvia starts staying here, Sylvia's bed is just a pile of dirty clothes. But at first, she's having a great time. Her and Jenny are having a great time because they're like, oh my God, we're with all these other teenage girls, Paula and Stephanie, and we're getting to have like girl nights all the time. I mean, it was like a constant party at Gertrude's house. It was a, quote, teenage utopia with no rules. And I mean, Gertrude made the kids attend church every Sunday, and they were always in perfect attendance for school. But at first, it's going great. I will never be able to understand for the life of me how you leave your darling children with somebody that you don't know. And I understand it was rough times. People needed the money. I don't know if I could have ever done that. But let me tell you who he left his children with, because we're going to get into exactly who Gertrude Banaszewski was. Gertrude Nadine Banaszewski was born Gertrude Van Fossen, and she was quite the daddy's girl. Her father adored her, and Gertrude knew it. She grew up during the Great Depression. She was the third of six children, and she spent every single moment that she could with her dad, and other members of the family resented how close Gertrude was to her father, and her mother was especially threatened by the closeness. When her dad wasn't home, Gertrude was ostracized. The other kids, her siblings, they isolated her, and she was bullied at school, not only by just students in general, but her siblings' friends would purposely bully her. When Gertrude was only 11 years old, she was hanging out in the kitchen with her father. Now, her father wasn't home all the time, but when he was, he spent every waking moment with Gertrude. And this particular night, the family had eaten dinner, and these two are still hanging out in the kitchen, and Gertrude is doing her reading assignments, and her father is cheering her on, getting really excited every time she gets an answer right. The two are hanging out, laughing, and her father has a heart attack right in front of her on the kitchen floor, and she witnesses this, and she would be irrationally blamed for her father's death. Like, her mother could never forgive her, and her mother would call her the root of all evil. After his death, her relationship with her mother just got worse. And I am talking way worse. So by the age of 14, she just gave up hope on ever having a relationship with her mother or even having female relationships in general, because nobody at school would be her friend. So she ended up hating to spend time with other women. And she always said that her mother caused her to feel this way. So she was a good-looking young girl, and boys were so interested in her. And of course, she adored the attention because that's how she grew up with her dad. So she wasn't getting that attention anymore. So getting it from these schoolboys was everything to her. She felt like she was in competition with every single girl for the attention of all of the boys. And she was pretty. She was allowing them to touch her. So that's why they liked her. And the whole town started talking about Gertrude's antics and how she was flirting with all of the boys. So every boy in school becomes interested in her, and every girl in school just despises her. So the only successful relationship that Gertrude ever had was with her father. So she associated that relationship with loving older men. So the only kind of men she dated were men that were at least 2 to 8 years older than her. So by the time she's 16 years old, Gertrude leaves home, she drops out of school, she leaves her mother's house for good, and she marries an 18-year-old police officer named John Banaszewski. So she had this relationship with the boys, and John knew about it. So he thought when he was marrying Gertrude, he was marrying this like hot, sexy woman that would do anything that he wanted in the bedroom. But he soon found out that Gertrude sucked in bed. pretty bad. And so he wasn't really digging her right away in this marriage. I mean, he's only 18. And he's like, dude, this girl has been lying about her reputation, apparently. He said that she wasn't only bad at sex, she was bad in the kitchen. She was a horrible cleaner. And he starts to realize that, you know, Gertrude had this horrible relationship with her mother growing up. Her mother never taught her how to clean, never taught her how to cook. So he's feeling like, holy shit, like I really got a bad deal on this whole housewife thing that I was getting myself into. So it wasn't until their first child is born, Paula, that Gertrude starts paying attention to things like cleanliness and nutrition and being a good wife. So they end up having four kids together. And she is now finally becoming the wife that John always dreamed of. Except in the bedroom. She still sucks in the bedroom. You know, normally here's the part where I would be like, well, how is John in the bedroom? We don't know, but Gertrude's a literal piece of fucking shit, so we're not even going to talk about that. We're going to let John say whatever he wants about her. But what we're not going to be happy about is the fact that John becomes an abusive asshole, and he starts beating the shit out of Gertrude, and that is because he's mad. He's mad that she's being a mom. She's paying more attention to the kids than him. All around, this entire story is just horrible. So, okay, let's get through this as quick as we can because this story breaks my heart in every possible way. The household was quoted as totally violent and horrible. There were, quote, brutal bouts of domestic violence, and Gertrude never told anybody. She never went to the hospital, and John would beat her because she looked at him the wrong way. Because she was wearing something that he didn't like, because she spoke a way that he didn't like, he would just beat her whenever he felt that he wanted to. Also, you got to remember, John's a police officer. So, I mean, he's hitting her in all the right spots, too, where bruises aren't going to show up. And he didn't want to jeopardize his job. So she never told anybody because she also has four kids at this time. She can't afford to run away with her kids. She can't afford to have her husband lose the job. So she just suffers in silence. And she ends up leaving John, and she meets a new guy named Eddie Guthrie. Now, Eddie Guthrie was an unemployed man, and she spent all of her own money for him on alcohol. And he wasn't much better than John. I mean, at this point, she's getting child support from John because her and John had three kids before they divorced. So Eddie's just milking her for all of this money. She's still doing things like odd jobs, washing neighbors' laundry to make money. And oh, the best part about Eddie, this guy that she goes and marries, Eddie hates kids. So what does Eddie do? He marries a girl that has four. Eddie hated the kids. He was mean to the kids. He hit her children. And he also hated the way that the mother paid attention to the children. I'll never get over that. Now listen, for someone who had a supposedly fantastic father who adored her, Gertrude sure picks some pieces of shit along the way. So somehow Gertrude gets Eddie to stop drinking. And everything gets better. He says, oh my God, I love this. I love waking up not hungover. I'm going to get a job. And she's like, holy shit, this is amazing. And he goes and gets a job. And now that he's this sober dude that makes his own money, he's like, yeah, fuck this. I'm leaving you and your kids. I'm going to go get someone younger and hotter. And he leaves her. So she was fine that he left. Even in the divorce settlement, they're in court and the judge asked him, you know, what are the reasons you want to leave this marriage? And his reason was, no joke, her children annoy me. So Gertrude was like, fine, leave. That whole relationship lasted about a year and she is still getting child support payments from John. So she's doing okay. But then one day Gertrude sees John, her ex-husband, the father of her children, on the street one day, and boom, they're back together. And of course, the kids are really excited. They love their dad. Their dad was great to them. So John moves back in, and these two get married a second time. This lasted a year until she gets pregnant again. So now she's having John's fifth child. But Gertrude has a miscarriage, and she falls into this deep, dark depression. So after this miscarriage, she does go on to have 2 more children with John, and then he leaves again. So at this point in total, it is 6 children, and now she is a single mother again. 3 failed marriages. She's 37 years old. She's a single mom with 6 kids, and she meets a man who is 10 years older than she is, and he is married, and she seduces him, and he leaves his wife, gets divorced, but keeps the home, and then Gertrude and her 6 children move into this man's home. His name was Dennis Wright. And you know what? Dennis was also one of those guys that just didn't want any kids, so he moved in with a woman with 6. And real quick, Dennis figures out that Gertrude is messy. Just not what he thought she was going to be. Just the same things that John thought in the beginning. His house was a disgusting mess. Now, he used to live here with his ex-wife and everything was perfect, but he wants out. He definitely doesn't want to be living with 6 kids that weren't his. He wanted to leave, get himself out of this mess. But he comes home one day after he's decided he's going to bail. He comes home and the house is like spotless. It's so clean and it felt like home again. And Gertrude has made dinner. All of the kids are quiet. He's like, oh my God, wait a minute. I think I might be able to do this. And then Gertrude starts seducing him and they have sex. And Dennis is down. He is like, I'm not leaving this lady. This could be good. You know, maybe it was just the messy house that was messing with my head. So they finish having sex and Gertrude informs Dennis that she's pregnant. And how do you think Dennis reacted? He didn't want kids, right? Dennis yelled at her. Dennis beat her. I don't usually do this in the middle of a story, but I'm just going to give you a trigger warning right now to skip ahead a little bit because Dennis is horrible. And Dennis beats Gertrude in that bed to the point where she lost the baby the very next morning. And he was screaming at her. He wanted the baby out of her. And he wasn't going to let her do this to him. So Gertrude loses that baby. But Gertrude gets pregnant again. And I'm talking very quickly. Now, if you've seen the movie An American Crime, James Franco is named Andy in that film, but he's supposed to be Dennis. And in the film, they make him younger and they change his name, but that's Dennis. So she tells him that she's pregnant again. And he says, okay, fine, let's have the baby. And they name that baby Dennis Jr. And right after that baby is born, Dennis Sr. bounces for real. He leaves them high and dry. So here's the thing. Gertrude is all about keeping up appearances. She wants to look like she's fantastic to the outside world when inside of her home, it's a complete mess. And so she tells people that her and Dennis were actually married because she didn't want people to think that her son Dennis was born out of wedlock. That was her big issue with this whole situation. And so the neighborhood thinks, wow, he just left her. She's a widow, basically, is what she's telling people. I don't know how she was telling people that because so these rumors start about, you know, Dennis leaving Gertrude with all of these kids. And at this point, John has stopped paying his child support because he was like, hey, listen, lady, you just moved in with this guy, Dennis, and he has this big fancy house. I'm not paying you any money, which is, you know, John, that's bullshit. But that was John's thinking. And so he stops paying her child support. Dennis leaves and all of the neighbors are feeling bad for her because they're like, oh my God, poor Gertrude. She has nobody and no money. Let's start giving her odd jobs. And that's how she starts getting the jobs where she's like, ironing and sewing. People don't really need it from her. They just feel so bad and they're giving her money for doing chores. So again, Gertrude is a single mother in 1965, living alone with 7 children, and this is where Sylvia and Jenny enter the story. Now, Paula Banaszewski, the eldest daughter, Gertrude's firstborn baby, Gertrude did say some quote to a man that she was dating. She said something like, I love all my children, but I would have been happy with just having the first one. She was so obsessed with Paula. Like, her and Paula were best friends, and she didn't even really have a mother role with Paula. She had more of just a best friends, best girlfriends. And Paula had this really warped understanding of the world because look at her mother. Look at all the choices her mother has made. So Paula's basically head of household in this home because Gertrude was so out of it all the time. Like, Gertrude just wasn't mentally there. She was exhausted. She just wasn't being the mother that she should have been. And all the neighborhood kids are always in and out of this house, smoking, drinking, all hours of the day. Paula started having an affair with an older guy that she met in a bar, and he was 30 years older than her. And she would sleep with this guy at motels. And one day, she asked him about getting married. And this dude was like, "Girl, I'm already married," and pulls his wedding ring out of his pocket. Okay, so 2 months after, this man is like, "I don't want anything else to do with you." Paula finds out she is pregnant. Now, Gertrude takes her to a doctor, and the doctor says, "Your daughter's pregnant," and this pushes Gertrude into full-blown mania. She is beyond her usual catatonic state, and Gertrude becomes vicious as hell. At this point, when she's this vicious monster, Sylvia and Jenny are already living in her home. Gertrude is basically denying that Paula's pregnant. It's like it didn't happen. It's like she didn't hear the news. It's like she can't see her little baby bump starting to form. She's just completely in denial. So Gertrude's stressed out beyond belief. She's got these two new girls living in her home, and she's waiting for the mail. It's been 2 weeks now, and she's supposed to have money from Lester Likens, the girl's dad, and the money doesn't arrive. And so Sylvia and Jenny arrive home from school that day, and they notice that the house is unusually quiet. There's always like a ton of kids in the house, but there's no noise. It's very quiet. And Gertrude tells them, "Listen, I took care of you two little bitches, for 2 weeks for free. And you know that since Jenny had polio, and Sylvia took care of her a lot, Sylvia was always very protective of her. Now Gertrude's getting loud, and Jenny is really, really frightened. Sylvia's frightened, but Sylvia's willing to take the brunt of any beating, of any yelling for her little sister. And Gertrude yells to Sylvia to get down on her bed being the pile of dirty laundry in the bedroom, telling her to get her face down on the bed. Oh God, I hate talking about all of this. Okay, I'm going to try to go through it as quick as I can. She rips off Sylvia's skirt and her underwear, and she whips her right there in front of Jenny. And I'm telling you, Gertrude's kids just watch like this is some TV show. And then she pushes Jenny down, and she tries to beat Jenny while she's yelling, "That bastard hasn't even sent me a measly dollar. If he don't pay you two, I will beat you." So she grabs Sylvia again and hisses into her ear, "If your daddy doesn't pay tomorrow, you'll get it again. And then I am, quote, renting you girls out at a dollar a ride until I make my money." And guess what? Lester's check arrived that morning. It was just late because of the post office. That's it. He was paying her regularly. The yelling, the beating, it becomes a daily thing. I mean, Gertrude's yelling at Sylvia mainly for nothing. There was this one time, I guess Sylvia got some candy on the way home from school. She got home, she had the candy. Gertrude sees it. She's like, "Are you stealing money from my family? How did you buy that candy?" No, like Sylvia got the candy from doing some odd job after school, I guess. She made some money, and so she went and bought candy as a special treat for her and her sister. Gertrude starts referring to her as the little thief. She's stealing from our family. And so at this point, the girls are starting to avoid Gertrude as much as possible. One day, the church that they all attended, they had this raffle, and there was going to be a picnic. So the girls were really, really excited to go to this picnic because at least at the picnic, they're going to be able to eat because they were just not given any food at Gertrude's house. So the reverend of this church, he starts noticing how skinny the Likens girls had gotten since they were living with Gertrude, because everyone in town knew that Sylvia and Jenny were living with Gertrude. So he was just assuming that it was because Gertrude's a single mother. She's very poor. She can't afford to feed these kids. So he was giving Sylvia and Jenny extra food, some extra chocolate cake. And you might be wondering at this point, why is nobody stepping in? I don't have a reason. I don't have an answer for you, because it's actually insane how not one person helped these girls. I mean, obviously we could say, but it was the 60s. And we say that with a lot of things, but it was the 80s, the 90s. But why did it have to be a different decade for people to be good human beings? It's really crazy to me. So Gertrude starts ridiculing Sylvia in front of her kids on a daily basis, and her kids would laugh. They thought it was hilarious. This was like their little after-school special. Let's watch Sylvia get ridiculed. So this one time, she's mocking Sylvia for eating so much at the church raffle. She's making fun of her. She's calling her the little piggy. She's making snorting noises and saying, "How could you eat that much, Sylvia?" She's shaming her in front of the whole neighborhood, basically, because all of the neighborhood kids are standing there. And Sylvia starts crying. And Gertrude tells her, "You know what? If you keep eating like that, you're going to get really fat and no boys are ever going to like you, Sylvia." Gertrude would get really excited when she made Sylvia cry. And she starts telling her that the whole neighborhood is going to shame this family now. They're going to be talking about this family because Sylvia had to go and eat so much food at this raffle. And she drags Sylvia into the kitchen. Now, I'm gonna tell you some things that she did. I'm not gonna tell you everything because I can't. I just want to get through this. So she drags Sylvia into the kitchen and she like takes this really hard old hot dog bun. She puts this old sausage into it and she forces it down Sylvia's mouth. Like she literally forces it into her throat. And then she takes it out. She's pouring a whole bottle of mustard, a whole bottle of ketchup onto it, and she's ramming it into her mouth while she's calling her a little bitch and telling her to eat it. Obviously, Sylvia's gagging, and she's saying while she's gagging, "No man will ever want you if you're fat and you lose your tight little body." She's 16. "You will end up alone in a house full of kids," she says to her. So is Gertrude like projecting onto Sylvia? Sylvia throws up, and, you know, Gertrude makes her eat the rest of this sausage hot dog, and Sylvia throws up again, and then Gertrude forces Sylvia to eat her own vomit. This whole time, her fucking nasty little children are standing in the doorway laughing at this, like this is some kind of joke. And that was just one of Gertrude's torture techniques on Sylvia. And I have to tell you, something that shocks the hell out of me after this incident happened is that Gertrude actually took Sylvia and Jenny to go visit their parents. Their parents wanted to visit them, but Gertrude was like, "Hell no, nobody's coming into this house because she's going to get caught. She's going to get in trouble." So she packs up all of her kids and the Likens girls, gets on a bus, goes to see the parents. And the kids say nothing to the parents. Even when her mother, Betty, notices, "Wow, Sylvia, you are really skinny. Like, what is going on?" And Gertrude butts in and she's like, "You know what? She's been trying to look good for the boys lately. She's been on this weird teenage diet. That's all it is." And Betty lets it slide. And Lester lets it slide. And then they put their kids back on a bus to go back to Gertrude's house. So at some point, Sylvia and Jenny become close to the two oldest Banaszewski girls, Paula and Stephanie. And one day, all of the girls are hanging out in this bedroom, and Sylvia's enjoying this time because she's like, "I'm not getting yelled at. Nobody's laughing at me. I'm having fun with these girls. I'm getting to experience teenage girl shit, you know?" So they're all talking about boys, and Paula's talking about her older man. And Sylvia spoke up briefly about this one boy that she kissed. She went steady with him. They only kissed a couple of times. Stephanie's talking about her boyfriend, Coy. Yeah, his name is Coy. He's a neighborhood boy who she said he was just like the dreamiest boy that ever existed. So while they're talking, Gertrude is standing in the hallway and she hears Sylvia talk about this boy that she kissed once. And she burst into the girl's bedroom and she's like, "I can't believe I let such filth into my home. Everyone knows you're a filthy prostitute, Sylvia." Meanwhile, her daughter is pregnant and she's still pretending that she's not. So Gertrude pushes Sylvia down. Sylvia's sitting in this chair. She just runs at her, pushes her. Sylvia falls down, knocks her head on the floor. And again, all of the dirty little neighborhood kids are standing around laughing. Just giggling their heads off. And it seemed like every time Gertrude had an audience, she would get worse. It was like their laughter fueled her. These kids are laughing, they're cracking up, and Gertrude starts kicking Sylvia in between her legs, just nailing her. And she tells the boys that are there, the neighborhood boys, you guys grab her legs and open them. And she keeps kicking Sylvia. And she's screaming to these children, Sylvia's pregnant and everyone should hate her. And her new punishment after this becomes that Sylvia is not allowed to sit in a chair, ever. She's never allowed to sit down in that house. She can lay in bed at night, but during the day, she's not allowed to sit down. So this rumor starts at school right after this situation. And the rumor is that the two Banaszewski girls, Paula and Stephanie, have been having sex with boys for money. So friends of Paula and Stephanie, because let me tell you, Paula and Stephanie kind of ruled that school. So their friends start hunting down who started this rumor. We need to know who's saying this about our friends. So while she's at school, Stephanie is jokingly propositioned by this boy who told her that the Lycan sisters started this rumor about her, that she's basically having sex for money. So Stephanie gets home from school that day and Stephanie yells at Sylvia and Jenny about this rumor. She's like, did you start this rumor? Stephanie full on punches Sylvia in the face in response. And Sylvia is apologizing to her. She's in tears. And Stephanie also starts to cry. But Stephanie's boyfriend, the dreamy 15-year-old Coy Hubbard, he heard the rumor too. And he starts brutally attacking Sylvia. I'm talking slapping her, banging her head against the wall, flipping her backwards onto the floor. And when Gertrude found out about this rumor, Gertrude took a paddle out and starts beating the hell out of both girls. But Coy, he's starting to become worse than Gertrude. He says that he wants revenge on Sylvia and Jenny because they started a rumor about his girlfriend. He's yelling, why would you say this about my girl? So he looks over to Gertrude and she tells him, you can hit her if you want. Why don't you just take out your aggression on her? I'll allow it. And he does. He beats the hell out of this 16-year-old girl while Gertrude and the kids, the dirty little children, sit there and laugh. And Gertrude, let me tell you something about her. She loved to flirt with these little 15-year-old boys that were in her house. So she starts flirting with Coy. This is her daughter's boyfriend. He's 15. She's like, oh my God, you're so good at judo. I've never really seen a man be so good at judo. I don't know what she's saying. And she tells him, you can always come over to my house and practice your judo on Sylvia if you want, because she deserves it. Obviously, she has to keep Sylvia out of school for a little bit after this. She is covered in bruises. So Gertrude, she lies to the school. She says that Sylvia has the flu, so she'll be back soon. And Sylvia does go back to school. She has to wear makeup to cover her bruises. Now, in order to create this scenario, create this reality where Sylvia is the bad person, Gertrude starts lying to people. She's lying to school officials. She's lying to friends of Sylvia. She's telling them that Sylvia is a liar. Don't believe anything she says. She spreads rumors. She talks shit about everybody. She is not to be trusted. Sylvia comes home from school one day, and of course, all of the teenagers are in the home. All of the neighborhood kids are in the home. And this girl named Judy Duke, she walks up to Sylvia. She slaps her in the face and yells at her and says, why are you telling people my mother is a hooker? And Sylvia's like, what? I don't even know what you're talking about. I don't even know you or your mother. So Gertrude is telling these children lies to make them hate Sylvia. And Gertrude is laughing that Judy's slapping Sylvia in the face. And Gertrude says, hey, let's make this more fun. Let's get Jenny to hit her sister in the face. And Jenny is like, no. And she's hysterical. She's crying. All of the kids are watching, laughing, egging Jenny on. And Sylvia's just like, Jenny, just do it. Just slap me in the face. And Jenny does it. This is becoming a regular occurrence. The neighborhood kids are coming in to watch Sylvia get attacked by Gertrude, get attacked by the other kids. Gertrude starts burning Sylvia with the cigarettes now. She's doing this in front of the other kids, and then she's encouraging the children, the teenagers in the room, to also burn Sylvia with cigarettes. And she became a, quote, living ashtray. Sylvia's body can't heal from these burns, from these beatings. She's not being given any food. She has no nutrition in her body. Her body doesn't know what to do. It's not able to fix itself. It's not able to heal. She needs food. And she starts realizing, like, I'm going to have to get myself some food. And she starts sneaking out of the house in the middle of the night, and she'll steal empty bottles and return them for change so that she can buy some food. So one night she escapes, she goes out, she gets some food, but Gertrude catches her sneaking back in, and she refers to her as the Lady of the Night. And she starts telling the other kids, oh, look, Sylvia's a Lady of the Night. She leaves the house in the middle of the night to go get money from men, and she has sex with them. So all these neighborhood kids are standing there, and she is calling Sylvia the Lady of the Night, and she makes Sylvia strip for these teenage boys. And then, okay, this is the part I did not want to talk about. Okay, she makes her strip in front of these boys, and then she hands her a glass Coke bottle, Coca-Cola, and she forces her to shove that bottle inside of her while the boys chant, do it, do it, do it, to the point that Sylvia passes out. After this incident, Gertrude starts making Sylvia stay in the basement. And she would bring in her daughter's boyfriend, Coy Hubbard, and her own son, John Jr., and also the neighborhood boy, Ricky Hobbs. And she would have them carry Sylvia up from the basement to the bathtub every day to wash her. And neighbors could hear everything. I mean, the neighborhood boys are helping take her up and down from the basement. The neighbors can hear Sylvia screaming. I mean, especially when she's being burned by cigarette butts. And let me tell you, oh yeah, the reverend of the church, he even stops over for a little visit while Sylvia's basically half alive down in the basement. And he also gets charmed by Gertrude. He asks, you know, where's Sylvia been? Haven't seen her in church. And Gertrude lies and says, well, listen, her exact words, she services married men, Reverend. Sylvia services married men. So we had to send her away. We had to put her in juvie. And the Reverend is like, oh, cool. Okay, cool. Bye. See you next week in church. I mean, it is bad now. Sylvia is barely hanging on, and her sister Jenny says, you know what, we should write a letter to our sister Diana, because remember, they have an older sister named Diana who lives now with her husband, but she is in a very rocky marriage. So Diana receives their letter, her little baby sister's letter, and she doesn't believe them. She thinks that they're just trying to live with her, and she's already in this really messed up marriage, and she's trying to fix it, so she just disregards her sister's letter. She actually throws the letter away, but something keeps nagging at her, and she goes to Gertrude's house. She looks at the address on the letter. She's like, let's go see what's going on. She goes to the house. She says, can I please see my sisters? And Gertrude answers the door, and she said, no. Nope, your dad, Lester, he told me never to let you next to your sisters. You don't get to talk to your sisters. He doesn't want you anywhere near them. And then she slams the door on Diana's face. But Diana is like, bitch, my dad would never say that. So she just lights up a cigarette and goes standing on the end of the street watching the house. And she is standing on that corner for 2 hours until she sees her little sister Jenny come out of the house with a bag of trash. And she runs up to Jenny and she's like, Jenny, what is going on? I have to get you out of here. And Jenny tells her, no, don't talk to me. I can't talk to you. I'll get in trouble if she sees me talking to you. Please don't do this to me. So Jenny goes back into the house, and Diana goes straight to a payphone and calls the Indianapolis Child Services, and she demands that they check in on her sisters. So you think that should be, this is the end, right? Sylvia saved. No, because they don't do shit. They show up at the house, social services. Gertrude tells Jenny she better shut her little mouth. Jenny does. And then she tells them, guess what? Sylvia's a prostitute, so I kicked her out of my house. And they look at Jenny, and Jenny looks like she's fine. And she's, you know, obeying her Gertrude, which, by the way, Gertrude has started telling them they need to refer to her as mom. So they are. And this social worker, she leaves. Little did that social worker, that reverend, know that right below their feet in that basement, little John Jr., he's charging kids in the neighborhood nickels to put cigarettes out on Sylvia. And they're They're giving them nickels and they're coming in and they're going down to that basement. She's all tied up. She's beaten half to death and they're burning cigarettes on her flesh. And then he's like, you know what? I want to make more money. So if you kids pay me a whole quarter, I will allow you to carry Sylvia back up the basement stairs and then shove her back down and we can watch her roll down all the stairs. Gertrude just keeps thinking of more, some of the most evil shit that she could possibly do to this little girl. And she comes up with an idea that they'll take some sewing needles and they will light the sewing needle with matches. And they're going to brand Sylvia. So they hold her down. They take the sewing needle and they light it with a match. Now she has her daughter, Shirley, lighting the matches and holding it to the needle. And then Gertrude takes the needle and she takes a marker first and she writes on Sylvia's stomach, "I am a prostitute and proud of it." And then she takes the needle that's burning and she digs it into the first letter, I, and she realizes this hurts her hand because it's really hot. So she looks up at 14-year-old Ricky Hobbs, the neighborhood kid who she's also flirting with constantly, and she's like, "Why don't you finish it?" And her little daughter, Shirley, starts heating the needle back up and he finishes that whole thing. "I am a prostitute and proud of it." They are branding that little girl with a burning sewing needle. And in the middle of this, Ricky looks up at Jenny, who's horrified, can't even speak. And he's like, "I want you to brand your sister too." And she says, no, she will not do it. And so Shirley Banaszewski takes over. Just to dig in a little more, Gertrude says to Sylvia, "You can't get married now, Sylvie, because no man will ever want you." They leave Sylvia down in the basement, and Jenny sneaks down there, her sister, and she's sitting next to her, and Sylvia says to her, "I am going to die. I can tell. I can feel it." The very next morning, Gertrude forces Sylvia up the stairs. She has the neighborhood boys carry her up, and they force her into a scalding hot bath. They dress her, and they sit her at the kitchen table, where she is forced to write a letter to her parents. And that letter started off, "Dear Mr. and Mrs. Likens, I snuck off with some boys in the middle of the night, and they beat me, and wrote, 'I am a prostitute,' on my body. I cost Gertrude doctor bills that she can't pay." So Gertrude's plan is to have the neighborhood boys place Sylvia outside in the darkness, in the cold, and let her die out there. And then her parents are going to receive the letter and everyone's going to think, you know, this is Sylvia's fault. Gertrude had nothing to do with it. She was just this wonderful woman that let these kids live with her. But they're not going to do that until they give Sylvia one last dark night in that basement. And of course, we have Coy again, Mr. Dreamy. Coy beats Sylvia one last time with a curtain rod down in that basement until she is unconscious. And in the middle of the night, Sylvia wakes up and nobody's in that basement with her. And she tries to scream, but she can't because her throat is swollen shut. And she finds this hammer. She's taking the hammer, she's banging it against the concrete in the basement. She's hoping that people outside can at least hear the noise and come investigate. And you know what? They find out later in court, neighbors did hear that noise, but not one neighbor ever helped Sylvia. They all turned their eyes. They were like, you know what? It's their business. The morning comes and it's the same routine. The neighborhood boys and John Jr. go down to the basement and they pull Sylvia up the stairs. They take her to the bathtub. They undress her. They place her in the water, but her head sinks under and no bubbles are coming out of her nose because Sylvia is already dead. And they pull her out of the tub and they're screaming and they don't understand what's happening. They just don't understand what could have possibly happened. They're freaking out. They try to give her CPR, but Sylvia is already gone. Gertrude has no idea what to do. She's freaking out. So she comes up with this plan. She's like, listen, get Sylvia to the basement. And when night falls, we're going to take her body and drop it off at a dump. So she calls the police before she actually removes Sylvia's body. She calls the police and she tells them, listen, I had this girl living here, and look at this note that she left. We don't know where she is, but she wrote this note about how she's a prostitute and all of this stuff. But while the police are there, The police officer looks over at Jenny, and Jenny just right out loud says, "If you get me out of here, I'll tell you everything." And this officer is like, "What the hell is going on in this house?" So this officer says, "I'm going to question everyone in this house right now, because we have to question if it's a missing persons. So everyone sit down and buckle up." And Jenny says, "Look in the basement. They killed her." "100 cigarette burns, second and third degree burns, severe bruising, muscular and nerve damages, multiple brain hemorrhages. She had bitten through both of her lips. Her throat and vagina were swollen shut." Gertrude, Paula, Stephanie, Coy, John Jr., and Ricky are all arrested on murder charges, and the officers serve arrest warrants to every single person involved in this story. Jenny told them every single neighborhood kid's name. Every single person was served an arrest warrant. Now, every single one of them that was served an arrest warrant, they all talked. Even the Reverend. The only people that wouldn't talk were Gertrude, Paula, Stephanie, Coy, John Jr., and Ricky. The trials begin, and one of the first witnesses to testify for the prosecution was the coroner. His name was Charles Ellis, and he testified that Sylvia suffered so severely. He stated that her fingernails were broken backwards. She had deep cuts and punctures covering almost her entire body, and that her lips were, quote, essentially in shreds due to her having bitten and chewed upon them. He also testified that Sylvia was in a state of acute shock for between 2 to 3 days prior to her death. So all lesser charges are dropped against everyone except for murder, and that would be Gertrude, Paula, John Jr., Ricky, and Coy, because Stephanie Banaszewski, her charges were dropped altogether because she turned state witness against her family. So every single person had their own lawyer except for John Jr. and Coy Hubbard, because they were trying to use their youth as a defense. And Paula Banaszewski, remember, she's pregnant. She goes straight into labor during her first court appearance, and she names her baby Gertrude. Gertrude's lawyer argues that she's old and she's mentally impaired and that the kids did all of it. He tries to set up this, like, how there was no supervision, it wasn't her fault, she was mentally impaired, and there was a Lord of the Flies scenario going on inside of that home. But Gertrude testified in her own defense, and she damned herself with her testimony because she got up there and she acted just as crazy as she always did. She was ranting on and on about how Sylvia's a prostitute. She always started fights. She's a thief. First of all, Sylvia could be a prostitute all day if she wants to. She could thieve all day if she wants to, and she could pick fights. But you don't get to do what you did, lady. The defense tries to get her 11-year-old daughter, Marie, up on the stand, but Marie just breaks. And she says, "I can't do it. I can't do it. My mom told me to lie." So Marie's testimony in this case is the turning point, and Gertrude is found guilty and given a life in prison, no parole. But the public was pissed. They wanted death. They wanted Gertrude to die. Paula was convicted of second-degree murder, and she appeals, but she took a plea deal to voluntary manslaughter, and she served 3 years. She moved and she tried to change her name, stay out of the public view, but that was until 2012 when Paula got on Facebook and she was exposed and fired from her teaching job because people found out who she was and what she did. And they were like, "Wait a minute, are you taking care of other people's children? Hell no, you're not." So, Paula, considering the situation you got yourself into, I'm thinking that going onto social media might not have been the best idea. John Jr., Coy Hubbard, Ricky Hobbs, 18 months in juvenile detention. John Jr., he served his time, and he gave some interviews after he was released, and he actually showed true remorse. He became heavily involved in the church until he died in 2005 from diabetes complications. Now, Coy, no. Coy never showed any remorse. That dude is a psychopath and a sexual sadist. And they, you know, the court agreed from the testimony and what was provided as evidence, they deemed him a psychopath and a sexual sadist. That's not coming from me. I mean, although it's pretty apparent from the way that he treated a 16-year-old girl, he was also involved in a double murder home robbery after he was released from juvie. He was also later identified online and ended up losing several jobs. Ricky Hobbs suffered a nervous breakdown right after he was released from juvie, and he died of late-stage lung cancer. Initially receiving life in prison without the possibility of parole, Gertrude Banaszewski appealed, and she was granted a new trial. And this time, the new trial didn't involve the testimony of her 11-year-old daughter. So this time around, Gertrude was given 18 years in prison, and apparently, she was a model prisoner. The inmates, the guards, they adored her. They called her mom. She was paroled in 1985. Gertrude never admitted to any wrongdoing. She never showed remorse. She actually said, "I never really knew her or what happened because I was on drugs the whole time. I wish I could undo it, but I can't, and I'm sorry." She changed her name to Nadine Van Fossen, and she ended up living with her daughter Paula. She died 5 years after being released from prison of lung cancer. Jenny Likens was adopted by the prosecutor, Leroy New. He had daughters of his own, and he said that Jenny fit right in. It always blows my mind when I hear that Jenny's parents left her with someone else again. After all of that happened, they went back to working the carnival. And this prosecutor, just like we heard in the Diane Downs case, this prosecutor stepped forward and took care of this little girl. This story doesn't seem real. I can't wrap my brain around it. I can't understand how there is such evil in this world. The author Ryan Green writes in the book Torture Mom that we might never really know the true story of what happened to Sylvia, because most of this story comes from the testimony. So there could have been worse things that went on in that home. And why? Why did she do this? Like, we might never know why Gertrude did this and how she was able to get those neighborhood kids to behave the same way. Like, what drove her to this type of torture? Did she see herself in Sylvia? And not one person helped that little girl. It was said that this crime can be described as the single worst crime perpetrated against an individual in all of human history. And that is why they went into hiding after this happened. They all had to go and change their names. They were so big and tough before kicking a little girl, branding a little girl, doing god-awful things I can't even believe we just talked about to a child. It is no wonder that they went into hiding and changed their names, because as the book Torture Mom states, there was a furious world out there that wanted revenge, and still does to this day, for what they did to Sylvia Likens. Stay safe and stay paranoid. Residue is created, hosted, researched, written, edited, and produced by me, Chrissy Champagne.